falcon flying proudly above it. But until that time, I want you out of Dorna, safe on our country estate with our sons to look after you.
How am I unsafe here? You're the king!
I know, he said, turning, smiling. But until the traitor Asher is dead, the city will be filled with Ulken from every corner of the kingdom, come to see him die and all doubtless unhappy with the curfew and other restrictions I've had to lay on them in the wake of his wickedness.
She pouted. Who cares if they're unhappy? It's their duty to obey you without question, and if they don't, they should be arrested.
And they will be, my dear. But you've told me yourself how this business has upset the staff, and it will only get worse before it gets better. There'll be no such upheaval on the estate. Besides, he patted her cheek, I must concentrate on my new important duties, and you know what a distraction you are. That had her simpering, the silly cow.
Oh, Conroyd, dearest.
So, my pet, you'll go to please me?
And what of my pleasure? She retorted, folding her arms. I only like the country in the summer, and anyway, I want to see that dreadful Asher die.
Out of patience, he snapped his fingers before a petulant face. Obedience! All the lively argument drained away, leaving her pale and docile, and, above all, silent. What a shame he couldn't so ensorcel every other Doranan in the kingdom. It would make things so much easier. Unfortunately, that was impossible. He'd have to find another way. It was vital he get rid of as many Doranan from the city as he could. The fewer magicians he had around him, the better, for even the most rudimentary practitioners would begin to notice the wall's decline. Provided, of course, he could achieve its demise. Unsustained by weatherworking, it would fall, eventually. But that would take too long, and too many questions would be asked in the meantime. The Doranan, sheep or not, would notice his lack of weatherworking. Holes would certainly begin to agitate, demand proof of his proficiency and the appointment of Dead Derm's replacement, and, if unsatisfied, would doubtless rally the kingdom's magicians against him. There was only one solution. He had to find a way to thwart Baal's will, to absorb her wretched weather magic into himself and unravel her wall from within. For if he didn't... First things first, however, he turned again to Conroyd's wife. You are leaving for the country, Etienne, willingly and with enthusiasm, eager to begin preparations for the creation of a new Doranan court. A happy thought occurred, and he laughed out loud. What's more, as soon as you arrive at the estate, you'll invite as many of the city's Doranan as can be accommodated to join you there, that they might assist you in those preparations. Make it a royal decree. You'll enjoy that, and they won't dare refuse.
Etienne nodded, witless and smiling. Of course, Conroyd. Whatever you say, my dear.
Not all the Doranan would go, of course. The damned councillors would stay, some of them, royal decree or not. Conroyd's friends, for certain. But many would obey the summons, greedy for the chance to make themselves indispensable to the new regime. And that would give him the time and space he needed to devise a way around Baal's safeguards against him. To kill her wall and her kingdom, once and for all.
Vera's kitchen was small and cozy. The walls were painted a buttery yellow. The drawn curtains were blue. The cupboards, the dresser, the table and chairs all were crafted from mellow brown timber and carved with acorns and wheat sheaves and lambs. Dried herbs in bunches dangled invitingly overhead, scenting the air. Seated at the table, Daphne breathed in the muddled aromas of sage, of dilly-tip, rosemary, thyme, and pods of tottle seeds, feeling oddly comforted. The stove in the corner wafted heat from its wood-filled pot belly. Standing before it, as though he'd grown up here, as though he belonged, Matt tipped fresh tea leaves into an old brown pot, then filled it from a kettle boiling on the stovetop. His back was to her, and he wouldn't turn around. "I don't understand it," she said, slumping partly against the wall, partly over the tiny table. The cushion on the chair was a blessing after the hard bench seat of Vera's wagon. "Why didn't you tell me you were coming here?" Matt said nothing. Vera, setting out plates, glanced at him. The look was as good as a poke with an elbow. He shrugged, said over his shoulder,
"We weren't on speaking terms, remember?"
She frowned, not liking the reminder.
"But how did you know where Vera lived? Even I didn't know where she lived. Not until she told me."
"And I told him too," said Vera. She'd shed her hooded cloak since coming inside. Plump and comfortable, she was layered in a patchwork of blue cotton and black felt and bright scarlet sheep's wool. Her long grey hair was coiled round and round the back of her head like an elderly sleeping snake. Slivers of silver-bound jet dangled from her soft earlobes, and her fingers were burdened with rings. Her eyes, dark brown and lively, were narrowed now in sharp consideration.
"Did you think you're the only one with the circle stone, child?"
Shocked, Daphne sat up.
"Well, of course not. But I didn't think..."
She stared accusingly at Matt's stubborn back.
"You were spying on me?"
"Cha!"
said Vera, disparaging.
"Spying. Twice I've spoken to Matthias since you and he fell in together. I called him to make sure I could, and after that stayed silent, hearing not a whisper until he reached out and told me he needed to hide."
She let her gaze rest broodingly between Matt's shoulder blades, wanted him to feel its weight.
"And was that all you told her?"
He refused to turn, pretended he had to guard the waiting mugs in case they sprouted wings and flew away.
"I told her everything I had to. You wouldn't."
She wanted to leap from her seat and beat her fists against him.
"You had no right! I'm the heir, not you. It was for me to tell, in my own time and in my own way. You've resented my feelings for Asher ever since you learned of them. Maybe he was right. Maybe you are jealous. You..."
He did turn then, his face white with temper and tiredness.
"Jealous? Don't flatter yourself. Believe me, Asher's welcome to you, eye-handed, self-opinionated, slum-scubbly woman that you are. So convinced that you're invincible just 'cause you're the heir. Well, you're not invincible. You didn't see this coming. You didn't see he had their magic in him, and maybe none of ours. And you wouldn't listen when I said over and over he needed to be told. If we'd told him, he wouldn't be in this mess."
For a moment, she could hardly breathe. Matt never spoke to her like this. Nobody spoke to her like this.
"You don't know that," she spat back at him. "You don't know anything. Telling him might have made things worse."
"How could they be worse?"
he shouted.
"Asher's going to die."
"Now that's enough,"
said Vera, and slapped her palm down sharp on the table.
"Both of you, I'm too old for all this wrangling, and besides, it won't change what's happened. There's been mistakes on both sides that can't be unmade now."
Her kindly face was tight with disapproval.
"Daphne, you've no business flying at Matthias. Yes, he told me all your muddle-headed doings, and then spent twice as long again making excuses for you. He's been a good and loyal friend, my girl. Better than you've deserved."
Hot with shame and angry embarrassment, Daphne stared at the knobbly pine-board floor. Couldn't bring herself to look at Matt. "I'm sorry," she muttered. Her voice sounded very small in the cottage's kitchen.
small and unremarkable, not the voice of an all-seeing prophet at all. She lifted her gaze. I'm just tired and worried. I'm glad Matt came to you, Vera. He'd have been in danger else. Vera sniffed.
Oh, he's still in danger, child. We're all of us in danger.
She looked again to Matt.
That tea ready yet, my boy?
Nearly,
he said, and pulled out a chair at the table for her.
Sit. I'll do the rest. Biscuits as well.
Vera settled herself in the seat with a sigh.
Of course, biscuits. Tea ain't tea without biscuits.
Briefly grinning, he opened a nearby cupboard and pulled down a large corked clay jar glazed red and blue, took a crock of honey from another, teaspoons from a drawer, and a pitcher of milk from a cool box set under the sink, and placed them on the table. Daphne stared.
Well, you've made yourself at home.
Frowning again, he turned away to gently swill the tea inside its pot.
I had to, didn't I? Seeing I was kicked out of my own.
She flushed.
Matt.
Vera rapped her knuckles on the tabletop.
No more, I said. Rivers don't flow backwards.
Reproved, Daphne closed her lips tight and looked at Matt instead as he busied himself with pouring the brewed tea. Despite everything, it was good to see him, large and practical in Vera's little kitchen. He'd lost his scent of horses, smelled now of honey pine and beeswax. His face was thinner, though, carved with lines she'd never seen before, and there was a sadness in him that was also new. Her doing. She felt her throat constrict and turned to Vera.
So, you know everything?
Vera's eyebrows lifted.
Everything Matthias knew, yes, which I'll warrant's not the same as everything there is to know. I've no doubt there are things you kept from him as well as me.
There was a look in Vera's eye that made her squirm.
Nothing important, I promise. Vera, what I did, it wasn't for me.
Handing out the tea-filled mugs, Matt made a small disbelieving sound. Her cheeks burned.
All right, not wholly for me. I hoped that if Asher and I were close, intimate, he'd believe he could finally trust me, confide his secrets, then I'd know how best to proceed. Prophecy's proven unreliable, Vera, unclear and even ambiguous, and it's never been constant. I couldn't see where it was leading us.
So you told yourself it led to that young man's mattress, retorted Vera. Which is where you've always wanted to travel.
Vera!
She's right, Dath, and you know it,
Matt said sharply.
We'll not solve a thing if we can't face the truth unflinching.
She didn't want to think about that. You don't seem very surprised, Vera, that we... Shrugging, Vera peered into a steaming mug, splashed in some milk and a dollop of honey.
It's true I ain't the heir no more than Matthias, but I've still got a good pair of eyes in my head and a knack or three of my own, she said, stirring. I could tell which way the wind was blowing.
Then why didn't you stop me, if Matt's right and it was such a terrible thing to do?
Did I say he was right?
Said Vera, and exchanged glances with him as he passed her a plate piled high with almond biscuits.
Did I say it was terrible? I don't recall saying that. We still don't know where this will end.
We've got a pretty good idea,
Matt said, glowering, and leaned against the kitchen bench. Instead of answering, Vera dipped a biscuit in her milky tea and ate it with lip-smacking relish.
Drink up, child, she said mildly, and then you'll do some scrying, and we'll see what we can see.
Daphne felt herself shrink with fear. She had no desire for tea.
Scrying? For Asher? Vera, I can't. Not tonight. I'm so tired. Maybe tomorrow.
Yes, tonight,
the old woman said, eyebrows pulled low.
Before sunrise. I've tried, but I can't seem to find him. Matthias says you never fail, no matter what the distance.
She glared at helpful Matt. He shrugged, his eyes cool and contained as he took a sip from his own mug. There was an empty chair beside her. He could have sat down if he'd wanted. Pain, quick and sharp. Such a gulf between them, greater than ever before. Could they cross it? Rebuild their bridges? Or was their friendship dead and buried, as Asher might soon be dead and buried? Of course, she wanted to see where Asher was, how he was. She was desperate to know. She was terrified of what she'd find out.
You must, child, said Vera, relentless. Knowledge is power.
All right, she said grudgingly, making no effort to be pleasant. If you insist.
They finished their tea and their biscuits, and Vera brought out her scrying basin, prepared the water, the tannel leaf, vervel, Cloyse's tears and moon rot. When everything was ready, Daphne looked at her and Matt, and said, still tetchy,
I'll make no promises in this. He might well be beyond me.
All I ask is that you try, child, said Vera. That's all I'll ever ask.
So she tried. A part of her so fearful, a part of her with hope. Deep in the tannel leaf's languorous grasp, she seasoned the scrying water and opened her heart. Sent forth her questing mind.
Asher. Asher. Asher.
Moments later she found him. Huddled. Hurting. Caged like an animal and abused by the very people he was born to save. Weeping, she told Vera and Matt what she saw in the basin and heard them gasp in turn.
We must help him,
she whispered as the tears coursed down her face.
We must save him. Can we save him? Is there time?
That's a question I can't answer,
said Vera, as she put her arms round Daphne's shoulders.
Not yet, but I promise you this much, child. We'll try.
We must save him. Can we save him? Is there time?
Tossed and turned by Daphne's desperate questions, Vera rose before dawn and tiptoed into her little kitchen to make a cup of tea. How odd! To be creeping thief-like about the cottage she'd lived in solitary for 27 years. But she knew already that Matthias was a light sleeper. Years of living with horses and their capricious maladies had honed him to startling alertness. She didn't know about Daphne yet, but chances were the child slept just as shallow. And since just now she needed quiet and time alone with her own bleak thoughts, it was best she played the mouse. She lit a single candle, then the fire in her stove to boil the kettle. Outside the window, darkness mantled her yard, the forest, the mountains. Baal's wall was a whisper of gold, lost amongst the stars. Sometimes it was easy to forget it was there, or that she was here because of it. Tied to a scattered group of not quite strangers whose lives she could end with one unthinking mistake, who knew her but not each other, and willingly lived with danger for the sake of an ancient prophecy and a life that had vanished centuries before they were born. Their courage had her weeping, if she let it. Guardianship of the circle had come to her 3 months before her 36th birthday. Married at 20 to a lovely boy whose face she no longer remembered, widowed childless at 23, she'd not had the heart to woo or wed again. At least for a long time she'd thought it was sorrow. After her great-aunt Tilda had died, though, leaving her a mysterious box and a legacy she still had cause to curse, She wondered if that wasn't prophecy working its will upon her, dabbling its fingers in her private doings long before it needed her, keeping her ready for the day when it did. For this day, when dark decisions must be made so that an even darker future might not come to pass. The kettle took a deep breath and started whistling. She whisked it off the stovetop and made her mug of tea. Cradling it between fingers, just beginning to feel the pinches of age, she sank into a chair at the table to rest her elbows and brood on matters like to break her heart. After sending Matthias and Daphne to their beds scant hours earlier, she'd reached out to another Circle member, Gilda Hartshorn, to confirm the truth of Daphne's scrying. A seamstress in Dorana City, Gilda sewed often for staff up at the palace and in the city guardhouse. She had a genius for gossip and inspiring confidences.
"It's true, it's true, all true," Gilda had told her. "Ash is due to die at midnight Baal's Day. A proclamation from the new king, Conroy Geralt."
Prompted by unfathomable instinct, knowing they'd need all the help they could find to rescue him, she'd told Gilda the truth about Asher. Shocked, then tearful, Gilda had demanded,
"But he's guarded day and night, and there's a crowd around him no matter what the hour. Vera, Vera, what shall we do?"
Gilda knew no more of Daphne and Matt than they knew about her, and still it was best things stayed that way. So she'd settled the seamstress's fears with a calm assurance, three parts a lie, then climbed in her bed to sleep. She was 63 years old now, and nowhere near spry, and the journey to collect Daphne had shaken her bones to aching. Sleep hadn't come, though. She'd told Daphne she had an inkling of an idea on how to save their innocent mage, and she did. But that idea was dreadful, merciless, uncaring of hearts broken, lives lost, futures trampled. Doubtless it came from prophecy itself, which accounted for its coldness. It also might account for coincidence, that of all the people who could be the key to Ash's freedom, it was her flesh and blood, her sister's son, a boy grown now to manhood who she'd brought into the Circle against her will, against all bonds of family, against the voice in her heart crying, "No, don't, choose another." She hadn't, couldn't. Like Daphne, like her nephew Raphael, she'd been chosen as prophecy's tool. She might rail against destiny from dawn till dusk, but it made no difference. Raphael was part of the pattern, part of prophecy. And so she'd called him to her, and willingly he'd come. Listened to her fantastic tale of omens and promises and dead men's dreams, and smiled. "Of course I'll help you, Vera. What am I meant to do?" Then, not knowing, she couldn't tell him. Now, suspecting, she couldn't bring herself to think of it. From the henhouse outside in the yard, a babbling of girlish chicken voices and the rooster's lusty crow. Lifting her head, she realized the sky outside had lightened, that tentative sun singers in the forest's foliage were warbling in chorus. It was day, and she had chores to do, decisions to make, plans to devise, prophecy to obey. She was 63 years old, and nigh on sick of prophecy. Her mostly untouched tea was cold now. Wrinkling her nose, she tipped it down the sink, then crept back to her bedroom, pulled on thicker socks and extra woolens, and lifted her coat from its hook on the back of the door. Matthias would be rousing soon, and maybe Daphne as well. She wasn't ready to face them yet. A walk in the woods was what she needed. Solitude, for the strengthening of heart and will. She'd take the pigs. Pigs were good listeners.
and they never talked back. When Asha stirred again, it was to a rising sun whose winter heat barely warmed his chilled and stiffened body. Far beyond caring about such niceties as privacy, modesty, shame, he pissed into the straw. The few remaining yellow stalks turned pink. In the square, the diminished crowd stirred and muttered and stamped its feet. A few half-hearted eggs cracked open on the cage roof. These ones were hardly rotten at all. Pale yellow yolk dripped onto his face. He opened his parched mouth and swallowed, because his belly was empty and rumbling. That small act of self-sustenance stirred his audience to anger. Someone shouted. Someone else threw a rock. Two rocks. Four. Five. One hit him, drawing blood. He threw it back, swearing. The next thing he knew, it was raining rocks, until the guards stepped in and stopped the sport. Not out of pity, they just didn't want an accident that might prevent his keenly anticipated beheading, or to get hit by mistake themselves. Adrift on a shifting sea of memories, swaddled in a sharp glass blanket of pain, Asha let himself float, praying that the next time he opened his eyes, he'd be dead. Gar woke to the sound of curtains rattling along their thick brass rods and an unwelcome voice.
Your Highness? Your Highness?
He rolled his head on the pillow, then frowned. What? That wasn't right. Since when was his pillow made of wood? Someone had crept into his bedchamber and turned his pillow into wood, and then they'd rolled it flat. He opened his eyes, blinking in the pale morning sunshine laid over his face like gauze. Oh, this wasn't his bedchamber. It was his library. The pillow was actually his desk, where he'd fallen asleep at some point during the night while continuing his search for Baal's diary. His fruitless search. If the diary existed, he'd failed to find it amongst Derm's books. It must be in Derm's study. If it existed. He was starting to think it didn't. That the diary was nothing more than a figment of Derm's dying mind. That hope for him, for Asha, for the whole kingdom, was truly dead. He sat up, groaning as every muscle protested his unorthodox mattress. His eyes were gritty, his mouth tasted like old socks, and his head hurt as though it was spiky with nails, and the sunlight was a hammer, pounding.
Your Highness, really?
Fussed Darren.
You hardly touched your dinner.
He rubbed his eyes, glanced at the abandoned tray on the floor with its burden of congealed roast lamb and soggy carrots. I wasn't hungry. What time is it?
7:15, said Darren, retrieving the tray. Now, sir, I've drawn you a bath. Please take it, and by the time you're finished, breakfast will be ready.
He felt his stomach roil. I'm still not hungry.
Hungry or not, Your Highness, you can't miss dinner and breakfast.
He groaned again. You're turning into an old woman, Darren. Right before my eyes. Darren sniffed.
Well, if I am, sir, you're hastening the transformation. Come along now. Up, up, up. Your bath water is getting cold.
Clearly there was no escape short of dismissing the old man. A tempting thought, but no. Glowering, he shoved his chair back from his library desk and staggered upstairs to his bathroom, where there was indeed a hot bath waiting. Darren had even laid him out fresh clothes. He didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Still, the hot bath, scented with oils, did feel good to his cramped and tired muscles. He let himself sink beneath the fragrant water and waited for the heat to suffuse him, for his headache to subside and his aching tension to ease. But no. With wakefulness and silence came more uncomfortable thoughts.
If Baal's diary did exist and was hidden somewhere in Derm's study instead of his book collection, could he hope to find it there? Without falling foul of Conroyd? Without alerting the bastard to his unpermitted wanderings and causing his limited freedom to be reduced altogether? He tried to imagine guards in Conroyd's pay cluttering up his tower, counting every step he took, every breath, and was forced to stop. Just the idea of it made him sick. But he had to take the chance. If he didn't, it meant he truly was Gar the Magicless again, forever, and faced a life of virtual imprisonment in a kingdom ruled by the wrong man, a life of unbearable guilt and sorrow. No matter what it took, no matter what it cost, he had to believe the diary was real and contained a means of rescue for them all. His bath was getting cold. He stood, dripping, wrapped himself in a towel and staggered into his bedchamber, where Darren was fussing over a small dining table. Odd. He couldn't recall having a dining table in here half an hour ago.
"I hope you don't mind, sir," said Darren, buffing silver cutlery with a linen cloth. "But I thought if you ate in here it might reduce the number of rooms to clean."
He looked up, stricken.
"Not that I begrudge the task, sir. I don't, but..."
"I know," he said. "It's a sensible plan, Darren. Whatever I can do to make your life easier, consider it done. And don't forget to set yourself a place, too. We're in this together, old friend." Darren's sallow cheeks turned pink.
I thought an omelette for breakfast, sir, with ham and asparagus, a little creamed cheese. I'll serve it momentarily, if that's agreeable."
Gar sighed. Darren was trying so hard, and his own life was just as disarranged, lay in equally smoking ruins. Through no fault of his own, he'd been reduced to housewifery in the service of a disgraced and impotent prince of nothing. After a lifetime's exemplary royal service, he'd earned much better than this ignominious exile. Eyes suddenly stinging, he smiled. "It's perfect. Thank you." The smile swiftly faded, though, as another unwelcome thought stabbed. "I can only pray Asher is treated so well." Something in the quality of Darren's silence made him stare. "What?"
"Oh, sir."
Darren's expression was anguished, his voice a strangled whisper.
"I don't know how to tell you."
"Tell me what?"
"About Asher."
His heart thudded. "For Baal's sake, just say it, man." Darren was wringing the linen polishing cloth as though it were a chicken's neck.
"I went and saw him last night."
"Asher?"
"Yes."
He felt his emptied lungs constrict.
"Why?"
Very carefully, Darren smoothed out the throttled cloth and laid it on the table.
"I was concerned. I thought you'd want to know if he was all right."
"He didn't. He had to."
"And was he?"
Darren shook his head, mute misery in his face.
"No. He's in a cage. In the square, on public display like an animal. Lord Geralt, the king, has hurt him."
"The king is a cruel and wicked man."
"Yes, sir,"
Darren whispered.
"I'm most afraid you're right."
Towel still clutched about his drying body, Gar moved to the window, pulled aside the curtain and stared down into the grounds below, where cheerful gardeners no longer worked. With an effort, he kept his voice steady. "And Asher, did you have the chance to speak to him?"
"Briefly, sir. He asked me to give you a message."
"A message?" The sunlight hammer resumed its pounding, and the nails drove into his brain. "There's no need, Darren. I can imagine what it was."
"No, sir,"
said Darren. His voice sounded closer.
"In fact, he asked me to say he forgives you. He understands the kingdom must come before all personal considerations, and that in denying him you did what had to be done so Lur might remain safe and at peace. He begs you not to blame yourself for his death.
Oh, he said eventually. I see. Slowly he turned from the window and stared into Darren's pale, composed features. That doesn't sound like Asher. Was he lying?
Darren shook his head, vehement. No, sir. Every word he said to me was the truth.
Well, if Darren believed it, and clearly he did, then he'd believe it too.
How was he?
His spirits are low, Darren admitted, reluctant. Which is only to be expected. I think he's afraid, though he'd never admit it. But he loves you, sir. I was wrong to think he never did.
A big admission from Darren. Garn nodded and turned back to the window, unwilling to trust his face, his self-control, to another scrutiny. He forgives you. And did that make things better or worse? He wasn't sure. Might never be sure.
You should get dressed, sir, Darren said gently. I'll be back in a trice with your omelette.
But when he returned some 10 minutes later, he brought with him not breakfast, but Willa. Smirking, resplendent in sky-blue satin, embroidered everywhere with House Geralt's falcon emblem, the horrible little man strutted into the room as though he owned the world.
I'm sorry, sir, said Darren stiffly. He insisted.
Garl looked at his former employee.
What do you want? You must know you're not welcome here, Willa.
The smirk widened to a fatuous smile.
On the contrary, Gar, as an emissary for the king, I am welcome everywhere. His Majesty sends me to say, surrender the weather orb and such books and papers removed unwisely from dead Derm's apartments.
With a flourish, he produced a sealed note and held it out. Gar, forced to step towards him as though in supplication, raised a hand at Darren's hiss of outrage and took the missive without comment, opened it and frowned.
This is from Conroyd?
From the king, yes. And mind you address him as such, with all his due respect.
Ignoring the little slug's snide tone, the temerity of his scolding, he continued to frown at the note. It was signed Conroyd the First, and its contents betrayed both character and knowledge.
To quote yourself to yourself, I disobey, and others suffer. Heed my emissary's demand without delay.
It was Conroyd's handwriting, no question of that.
And yet... Well, said Willa,
grown even fatter with arrogance and pride.
Must I tell His Majesty you kept me waiting? Fetch the orb at once!
Ignore him, Darren, said Gar as his secretary choked on a breathless imprecation. He's a cur-dog yapping from the shelter of his master's shadow.
Sir,
said Darren, and subsided, still bristling. The weather orb was here, hidden safely in his bedchamber. He'd intended to take it back to Derm's apartments, then changed his mind in case the weather magic's transfer to Asher had failed or faded and they needed to perform it again. In case he found his cure and was able to resume his role as weather worker. One thought unnecessary, the other forlorn. He retrieved Baal's gift from its hiding place at the bottom of his blanket box and held it out. Derm's books and papers are unboxed and scattered. I'll need time to ready them for the king. Willa took the orb's box gingerly, as though it were alive and may bite him.
1 hour. House Geralt's servants will come to collect them. Be advised. Don't make them wait.
Gar smiled thinly. And when you give King Conroyd the orb, Willa, give him this message with it.
he would do well to reconsider keeping Asher in a cage. Such unkindness sets a tone for his reign that some might find disconcerting.
You are the only one who thinks so, retorted Willa. Didn't Darren tell you? They're lining up 10 deep in the square to get their look at the traitor from Resthaven and pelt him with the refuse from their dinner tables and byres.
A lifetime of controlling his feelings in public kept his face from revealing any pain. Contempt, though, contempt he'd reveal, and gladly.
And I suppose you couldn't wait to join in, could you? You must feel very proud.
Willa flushed, lifted his twice doubled chin.
Derm's books and papers in 1 hour, or deal with His Majesty's wrath.
I'm so sorry, sir, said Darren once Willa had departed. I'd have kept him out if I...
Gar held out Conroy's note. What do you make of this? Baffled, Darren took it, read it.
I'm not sure I know what...
It's Conroy's penmanship. After 2 years on the Privy Council, I'd know it anywhere. So should you by now.
But...
He shook his head. Don't you think there's something odd about it? Darren examined the note again.
I'm sorry, sir. No.
He frowned.
Perhaps it's a trifle unsteady.
You do see it, don't you? Gar said. It's Conroy's hand, and yet it's not. As though... And then he stopped. The idea was too fantastical for words.
Yes, sir.
Darren prompted.
As though what?
He took back the note. As though someone else's hand was laid over Conroy's as he held the pen to write.
Oh, said Darren. I see. Yes. Well, that would be very odd, sir.
Never mind, he said, and crumpled the paper. I'm imagining things. Darren, I need your help.
Certainly, sir, said Darren.
He sounded relieved.
Doing what?
Derm's books and journals. I want to go through them one last time before I have to give them over to Conroy. I don't know, it's a slim chance, but I keep thinking I might have missed it.
Missed what, sir?
He took a deep breath. This secret was a luxury he could no longer afford. As he was dying, Derm told me he'd found a diary. Baal's diary. He seemed to think it was important. I want to find it. I want to keep it out of Conroy's hands. Darren's eyes were open wide.
Sir, if it's true, why, it might change everything.
That's what I'm hoping for, he said, and pulled a face. Praying for. Derm called the diary our only hope. And it's my hope he was right. He warned me against Conroy. Somehow I think he knew disaster was brewing. But we've only got 1 hour. Breakfast will have to wait, I'm afraid. All your hard cooking...
Breakfast can burn, sir, for all I care, said Darren firmly. Let's get at those books.
Chapter 26. When Daphne woke in the trundle bed Vera had made up for her, she saw through the partly closed sitting-room curtains that the sun had crawled high in the sky. Around her, the cottage felt uninhabited. As she blinked muzzily, trying to arrange her frothy thoughts, she heard the ringing crack of an axe blade against wood coming from somewhere outside. After using the chamber pot and dragging on fresh clothes, she poked about the rest of the cottage, just in case her feelings had fooled her and Vera was there to talk to after all. But no, the cottage was empty of both Vera and Matt, so she let herself outside through the kitchen door and into the cottage's tree-fringed backyard, where Matt was chopping firewood. He glanced at her, not angrily, but not in a friendly way either.
Vera's taking the pigs for a walk, he said,
lining up a fresh round of timber on the block.
There's no saying how long she'll be gone.
I left oat mush on the hob for you.
I smelled it, she said, and perched herself on a handy tree stump. The thought of food was revolting. Her belly was greasy, rolling with nausea. Maybe later. She kicked her heels against the stump. The three black and white chickens scratching the grass nearby took frightened offense and scattered, squawking. He nodded. Drenched with regrets, she watched him continue his chopping, distant and entirely self-contained. The man she'd known in Dorna was vanished. In his place stood this stranger with hooded eyes and a grim mouth and no exasperated pleasure in her company. In the mid-morning light, the chasm between them looked no easier to cross than it had last night in Vera's kitchen. Before drifting off to sleep, she'd replayed over and over in her mind the sequence of events that had brought them to this time and place, the decisions she'd made, the choices she'd discarded in favor of silence and subterfuge. Try as she might, she'd not been able to imagine herself doing anything differently. And whether that meant that as Javel's heir she'd been right and was guided by prophecy, or as her plain self she'd been nothing but a stubborn slum-scumbledy wench, she had no idea at all. In heavy silence, the haphazard pile of wood dwindled as Matt reduced the rough lumps of seasoned timber to tidy logs and kindling, his horseman's hands gripped tight around the axe handle, his weathered face severe with concentration. The useful stack of firewood grew taller and wider, and still he did not speak, and neither did she. Her heart and head were aching. She wasn't sure she'd ever been so sorrowed or felt so helpless in all her life. Because it hurt so much to look at this shuttered and newly unknowable man, she looked at her surroundings instead. A goodly garden had been created around the back of the cottage. There was a vegetable patch sprouting carrots and tomatoes and such like, three scraggly apple trees, a riotous herb bed and a hodgepodge of flowers. A clovery lawn patched the spaces between cottage and cultivation. Vera's pony cropped grass in a small paddock attached to a tumble-down stable off to the left, and on the right was a mildly odorous pig pen. Next to that, the hen house, its jaunty red paint faded and peeling. It was all very rural. Aside from the sound of Matt's wood chopping, the sharp calls of hidden birds and the answering cackles of Vera's hens, the forest hush was absolute, unsettling after the steady humming bustle of the city. But there was a kind of peace in it too, a balm to her lacerated soul. On any other morning, she'd have revelled in the solitude and thought of this interlude as a holiday, embracing it with passion. But all her passion had died. She'd killed it, with arrogance and pride and a refusal to consider she might be wrong, that Matt could be right, that being Javel's heir did not make her infallible. She wanted to tell him that, to say she was sorry and beg his forgiveness, but his shuttered face defeated her, made her more tongue-tied and unfairly angry. So she sat unspeaking and watched him cut wood. Eventually there was none left. Matt buried the axe blade in the chopping block with one mighty swing and said, sweating,
"Could be you were right after all."
For a moment she could only look at him, slum guzzled into silence. Then she found her meager voice and said, uncertainly, "What do you mean?" He inspected his palms for blisters, found one and popped it, frowning.
"I mean, about not telling Asher the truth."
Asher. Images from the scrying basin swam across her inner eye. She felt her heart constrict and her mouth suck dry. "How so?"
"What you saw was done to him. The way that Geralt hurt him."
She thrust away the bloodshed and the haunting echo of screams. "What about it? How can that mean I was right?" Matt looked elsewhere, into the distance of tangled trees.
"Who's to say what a man can know and not talk of when that kind of thing's being done to him? With all the will in the world, if he'd known who he is and what we're about, it's more likely than not he'd have told it to that poxy Dornan bastard, and then where would we be?"
She shook her head. "No, Ash is strong. He'd never have broken."
"You can't know that for sure. So the way things fell out, it's best you held your tongue and made me hold mine."
He glanced at her.
"That's the only thing you were right about, mind. As for the rest of it..."
Faint colour tinged his face.
"The futtering."
"What about it?" she said tiredly, feeling her own face heat. "You deny Ash's charge that you're jealous 'cause he's known me and you haven't and never will. But how can I believe you? You act like a man feeling robbed." For some time he didn't answer. Then he shrugged, glanced at her again, then let his gaze slide sideways into the woods.
"Believe me, Daphne, if ever once I loved you, I got over it soon enough."
And that hurt. Not because she wanted him to love her, at least not like that, but because there was a hardness in him now that before this moment she'd only ever noticed in herself. She'd done that to him, and wasn't proud to learn it. "I do love him, Matt," she said, worrying at a pulled thread in the fabric stretched over her knee, needing him to believe her. "It's not an excuse for what I did, but I suppose it is a reason." He nodded.
"I suppose.
I'm not sure why I love him, mind. The purpose behind it, I mean, not the bits and pieces of him that make me soft round the edges. And there must be a purpose, Matt. Mustn't there? Prophecy wouldn't have thrown us together for so long and in such a way that we fell in love if there wasn't a purpose."
"You're asking the wrong man. I've never much understood prophecy or its workings."
"And yet you followed it all your life. Followed me. Why?" He gave her a painful smile.
"Why does a dog chase rabbits, Daphne? Because it's in his nature."
In all the years she'd known him, she'd never heard him sound so defeated. "We can't afford to doubt now, Matt. We've come too far, risked too much and sacrificed more. We must see this through to the end, no matter how bitter it might be."
"I know that," he said tersely. "I'm here, aren't I?"
She longed to touch him, but was afraid he'd rebuff her. "What I did with Asher, it was never a trivial thing. I meant what I said about us being sworn in marriage, Balsman or no Balsman. His heart is mine, Matt, and mine is his, no matter what."
"I know," he said. "If I thought it'd make a difference, I'd say I wished you happy."
She felt tears well, burning her tired eyes. Never before last night had she cried in front of Matt. It had been a matter of pride and, she thought, necessity. But such things seemed pointless now, so she let them fall. "It makes a difference," she whispered, fisting her fingers in the folds of her skirt. "Never think it doesn't make a difference."
"Good," he said. "I'm glad for that."
"I can't believe he has their magic," she said. "He made it snow, right under my roof. How can an Olkin do that?" Matt shook his head.
"I don't know. Unless..."
"Unless what?"
"Could he have Dornan blood in him?"
The idea was outrageous. "How? Our peoples don't mix. It's forbidden." That made Matt snort.
"Olkin magic's forbidden, Daphne. Yet here we are. Aren't you the one who says all things are possible with prophecy?"
"Yes, but..." She shook her head. "It doesn't matter. He has their magic and I didn't feel it. How could I not feel it? It's my business to know the innocent mage better than he knows himself. and now because I've failed him he might die." Matt moved to her then, and folded her in his strong, sheltering arms. He smelled of sweat and leather, his jerkin warm beneath her cheeks as he held her against his chest.
"You mustn't lose faith, Darth. We have to trust in prophecy."
"I do," she sobbed. "I do. Oh, Matt, I'm sorry I sent you away. I'm sorry I've always been harsh with you, keeping you distant. I thought it was best. I thought I was protecting you."
"I know that,"
he said, and rested his cheek on her unruly, unbound hair.
"I always knew. And even though it irked me sometimes, I never begrudged you your snappishness. It's a sore burden you've been carrying all these years, Dath, and my only true sorrow was in knowing I couldn't carry more of it for you."
"You carried a lot, Matt. You'll never know how much. There were times I thought I could never keep going. I'd have despaired if you hadn't been with me, encouraging. I owe you so much. I owe you my sanity, and I never once told you. I'm sorry."
"Hush now, hush,"
he chided, rocking her gently.
"You're Gervail's heir. You've a task laid on you like nobody else, especially now, in the final days."
She pulled away a little and looked up into his face. "I may be the heir, but you're the heir's conscience, her wisdom and her strength. Is there anything you can tell me, Matt? Is there anything you felt that can show me a way out of this mess we're in?" She let out a long and shuddering breath. "That I've put us in?" He smoothed the tangle of hair from her face.
"I wish there was. What do your visions tell you?"
"Nothing," she whispered. "Ever since I lay with Asher, they've stopped coming, and I don't know why. I've never been so blind in all my life, and it scares me."
"Well," Matt said slowly, "could be they've stopped because they'd led you where you needed to be. With him. Could be you're right, and prophecy planned it all along."
"For what purpose? How does me lying with Asher get us through the final days? They must be close now, for Asher's revealed as our innocent mage. Oh, Matt, are you sure you don't know anything?"
"Vera's asked me the same question," he said, "and all I can do is give you the same answer I gave her. There's something amiss with the magic fluxes, but I don't know how or why. It's in the city because as soon as I left there, the uneasiness faded. But beyond that, if I went back, I might be able to tell more."
She tightened her arms around him. "No, you can't go back. With Asher arrested, they'll want his friends next, and we're his two closest. You're safe here."
"For how long?"
Gently, he pulled away and began pacing.
"There's not a man, woman, or child in all of Lur who will be safe when prophecy's finally fulfilled, Daphne, and your dreams become our reality. Our job's not over yet. We still have to save this kingdom from destruction."
"How?" she cried. "For that we need Asher, and I can't help him. Can you? Can anyone?"
"I can,"
said Vera's voice from behind them. They turned, stared. Daphne folded her arms about her ribs and held on tight. "How?" Vera walked out of the forest fringe and across the cottage yard to join them, her brown wool trousers soaked to the knees and her stout leather boots mired in mud. In one gnarled hand she gripped an old tramping stick, and at her heels snuffled two enormous mud-covered pigs, tame as dogs. Her wrinkled apple face was grim.
"With heartbreak and sacrifice, and a mortal lot of danger," she said. "But we must act swiftly. I had word from the Circle last night. Asher's appointment with the Axemen is set for midnight Barrel's Day next.
Daphne turned to Matt. I can't believe the king is doing this. Asha's his dearest friend.
If by the king you mean Gar, then that's more bad news, said Vera. Blair has a new king now.
Not Conroy Geralt, Vera nodded.
Yes.
Bar'll protect us, said Matt, and rested his hand on Daphne's shoulder. There won't be an Olkin safe anywhere.
Only if we fail, said Vera grimly. But if we are to save the innocent mage from dying and taking us all with him to the grave, you must do as I say without fratching. What's to come will come. Must come. Prophecy demands it.
Matt frowned.
I don't like the sound of that.
You're not asked to, Vera snapped. Daphne, put these pigs back in their pen, child, and see they have a good breakfast. You, Matthias, fetch knife and bowl from the kitchen. Cut me 2 sprigs from every herb and planting in the last row of the garden there. Tie a strip of cheesecloth over your nose and mouth. Be sure to put on gloves, and whatever your opinion of what you see and cut, keep it to yourself. Don't bring the cuttings inside either. Leave them on the ground beside the back door. When you're both done, amuse yourselves in the kitchen by making soup for lunch. All the fixings are in the pantry.
Bewildered, Daphne looked over at the herb bed. Cheesecloth and gloves? Vera's severe expression eased just a little.
For precaution only. I'd not put Matthias in danger.
She pulled a face.
Not from herbs, at least.
As she stumped past them on her way back into the cottage, Matt said,
And I like the sound of that even less.
Troubled, Daphne nodded, watching as the cottage's back door closed behind the old woman. Nor do I. But we'd best do as we're told, I think. Whatever it is she's planning, it's near torn her heart from her chest. Despite her village isolation and solitary cottage lifestyle, Vera kept her circle stones out of sight, in a hidey hole she'd dug beneath her bedroom floor and lined with discarded tiles from the village pottery. The neatly rejoined floorboards with their betraying finger holes for lifting stayed hidden beneath an old fraying carpet. Alone in her bedroom, with the door safely closed and curtains drawn, she rolled back the carpet, hoisted up the hidey hole's lid, and leaned it against the bed. 40 circle stones winked up at her in the flickering lamplight, looking no more important than a random collection of pretty quartz crystals, a magpie's playthings. 40 stones. 40 friends. No, family. 40 oaths solemnly sworn. So few to stand against the coming darkness. She hunkered down beside the hidey hole, grimacing as her knees protested. Raffelstone, a blue as pale as fresh skimmed milk, drew her gaze like a magnet. She picked it up, cradled it in her palm, and called to him. When he answered, tears sprang to her eyes.
It's time.
For long heartbeats, he said nothing. Then she felt him sigh. When we heard of Asher's arrest, I thought it might be. He is the one, isn't he? He's the innocent mage. She'd told no one save Gilda. Trust Raffel to guess the truth.
Yes, she said. It's him. Darling,
don't say.